You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is I'm Ready for My Close-Up. Continuing our spurious anniversary month, tonight's show coincidentally coincides with the 80th anniversary, well, yesterday if you want to split hairs, of the release of Hitchcock's film The Lodger. So having teased you with excerpts of my interview with Matthew Sweet, the writer and presenter of Silent Britain and Shepherd in Babylon, for the past 2 weeks, here follows my full interview with him on the subject of silent movies.
Have you managed to see many, then?
I've seen quite a few. I mean, I'm, I suppose, a fan of German Expressionist, in particular.
Well, they're the easiest ones to see, aren't they? They're the ones that have stayed in the repertoire the most powerfully, aren't they?
Yeah.
I suppose for all sorts of reasons, really.
Stylistic.
Yeah.
It's almost like because the Expressionist ones are that more sort of artistic and obscure.
Mm. Yeah.
People have made more of an effort to like track them down rather than ones that depict, I suppose, ordinary scenes. And
they were thought of as being, I mean, sometimes you read in reviews of films, it's full of German tricks. You know, a lot of people didn't like Hitchcock.
Right.
Because, you know, that scene in the, that famous moment in The Lodger where you look upwards and see Ivan Avello's feet walking on a glass ceiling.
Mm.
Moments like that were seen as being a bit, you know,
German.
A bit Teutonic.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, Fritz Lang did something like that in one of them, the abuse films, I'm pretty sure. You know, although whether it would have predated, actually, that was probably
27 temporary. Is the Lodger, so when he's doing,
I mean, he did three of them, but I'd have to Google it.
Mm.
But yeah, I think your German movies, it must have been interesting at the time, the way that they tried to market them around the world. I mean, in a way, it's probably the same problem we have with world cinema these days. Because I read of a screening of Cabinet of Dr. Caligari in New York where they added an extra prologue and epilogue that was done as some sort of Sonne Lumiere presentation where a voice would come on and say, the film you're about to see is not presented in a traditional manner and you have to bear in mind, you know, this and that.
That's interesting, though in a way it wasn't that uncommon as a practice, not to explain anything that was too exotic, but just to sort of enhance the experience. I mean, there were British films that would do just that sort of thing. There's a film called The Only Way, which is a version of a Tale of Two Cities, where if you went to the you know, the big screening in Leicester Square, the It's a Far, Far Better Thing That I Do speech wouldn't be shown to you on film, but the curtain would part to reveal Martin Harvey, the star of the film, who would do the speech in situ. And the same exhibitors often try to kind of whoop up a film by interpolating scenes like that. So you would, if you went to see Griffith's East is East at one of the Leicester Square cinemas again, you would see the film sort of reenacted in, or tableaus from the film live on stage. And that's how some stars were discovered, by being recruited to be in those tableaus. So
almost to like ease audiences from the practice of theatre into watching films.
Well, at a time when films were often being shown in theatres, yes, and when that was all very much more blurry.
I mean, I suppose you still get that in the provinces, that the local theatre shows films on an evening but has matinees.
Yeah, but also people just did things with there were no kind of you know, these days it wouldn't be allowed. It would be seen as studios would try and prevent things like that from happening. But actually, it was seen as a way of publicising a film. That it was part of the ballyhoo around a film, so that you would, you know, you wouldn't just see the film. You would see, I don't know, I remember talking to the actress Judy Campbell, whose father was a cinema owner in Grantham, and they showed a silent version of Peter Pan. And before the performance of the film, Judy Campbell, who would then would have been about 10, got up and got up on stage and sang a song called "Peter Pan, I Love You." And in Japan, in the silent period, you would get these people who stood either side of the screen and improvised dialogue and sort of explained what was going on. But again, it's, I suppose it's as much a legacy of films sort of beginning in the fairgrounds, really, that you would, an element of live performance. You know, you've got live music, so why not other sorts of live performance?
Yeah.
The cinema hasn't quite been kind of bottled.
Well, I mean, in a way, there's that feels like it's missing from presentations of not only silent movies, but movies in general these days. Because, I mean, I'm thinking of a couple of examples. I saw Disney's Mulan in the Odeon Leicester Square when it came out. And before that, there was a performance by the Chinese State Circus on the stage in front of the film. But, I mean, it's just such a weird combination of Chinese culture and Western culture. The fact that, you know, obviously this communist-trained circus troupe, to then show this horrible kind of American wishy-washy version of Chinese culture, which was only made so that Disney could get films released in China again, having upset them with the making of Kun Dun. And at the same time, McDonald's was sponsoring Chinese New Year in London, and so there were horrible McDonald's signs everywhere. So, but anyway, and the other example I'm thinking of was... they showed Nosferatu, which is more pertinent to our discussion, at the Royal Geographical Society a few years ago. And they had a guy on stage behind the lectern and a small three-piece next to him that were playing music, you know, on cello and whatever. And he was singing the intertitles in German or Romanian or whatever. And then up in the gallery behind the audience, there was a choir, and I use the term in inverted commas, who were making kind of whispering noises.
Mm.
And it was brilliant. I mean, it's the best presentation of that film I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, it's live cinema, isn't it? This is the phrase that's become attached to silent cinema. I mean, that phrase, silent cinema, sounds like something terribly dead, doesn't it? But actually, it's the most sort of in the moment, if it's done properly, the most kind of in the moment form of cinema that you can hope to encounter, really, because there are... you can import anything into it, really. The film is sort of the one kind of inviolable element of it, but around it you can do anything that you like. You know, you can put Battleship Potemkin on in Trafalgar Square with the Pet Shop Boys, or, you know, you can have any sort of musical or light accompaniment that you like. It's live cinema. It's not like going to the multiplex and seeing something that feels, you know, like the finishing touches were put on it and it's utterly standardised kind of experience. When you go and see a silent film, because you've got musical performers there as well, then, you know, every performance is individual. You know, the musicians aren't working to a score. They're just doing, looking at the screen and responding to it, as hopefully the audience are too.
In a way, it's almost like silent film was anticipating talkies if they had this element of narration occasionally, an introduction...
Well,
from Magic Lantern shows where maybe those would be narrated. You know?
What it is it's a rather sort of hybrid art. It's, I mean, you know, it's an anachronistic word, but it is sort of a multimedia experience. And in a way, it seems so much more rich than things that are offered to us today as multimedia, which often seem rather, you know, rather unsatisfactorily kind of mutant and unfocused. This is something that was developing into that was becoming highly refined. And in a way, the tragedy is that the jazz singer didn't come out, say, 5 years later, because maybe, and this is something you know, I've heard Neil Brand assert, and he's sort of the authority, I think, if that had happened and the talkies had arrived just a little bit later, then we might still have something like silent film, and it would be considered a separate art form, like, you know, opera, like ballet, something unto itself, because it's very unlike the talkie, the silent film. Very different kind of experience, very much more like going to a concert, very much more emotional, I think, in many ways, than going to a talkie. I mean, I don't want to sound a Luddite about it. I'm not one of these people who thinks that the you know, the talkies are a bad idea. Cinema did need that. Need to move into that, need to sort of expand itself in that way. But at the same time, it's a pity that all that was great about silent cinema and that those particular qualities that it offers did get lost. And if the talkie had come a bit later, perhaps there would still be, it'd be called something else, probably. Certainly wouldn't be called silent cinema, which is a name that it's just been saddled with because, you know, as a response to the talkies, really. It's a historical category.
Well, like, I suppose opera begat operetta, begat musicals, and they sort of continued to exist independently.
Absolutely,
rather than replacing each other.
You know? Yeah, Andrew Lloyd Webber did not destroy Puccini, even though his work owes a great deal to Puccini, shall we say.
Silent cinema still seems to be popular, though. I mean, I've been to various screenings at the Barbican, Richmond Town Hall, the NFT, wherever. And I mean, yeah, the odd occasion it's sort of half empty, but quite often it's still packed. I mean, what do you think? It's because of the performative nature, the interactive nature of the presentation?
I think it's something that is it's sufficiently marginal for the people who discover it to feel that they've really discovered it themselves. And I think that once you do, it's like happening upon a world. It's not something that everybody knows about. It's something that increasingly it's harder to discover. I mean, we know, people of our generation, I think, probably discovered silent cinema more easily because there was more of it shown on television. We had Chaplin on TV in my childhood was something common. It was something that happened in the summer holidays. You know, likewise, Channel 4 funded the restoration and scoring of dozens of silent films during the 80s and 90s. That all went when Michael Jackson came in and the channel kind of changed its colours. So although these screenings are going on, you know, there's lots available on DVD.
And also films that have been believed lost for decades are suddenly turning
up
on DVD.
Yeah, things are turning up. I mean, you know, sometimes in rather inferior
Maybe forms. Because DVD is more of a collector's format in some respects than VHS. That's why the kind of people who'd go to see a silent movie in the cinema would be more likely to buy it on DVD than they would on video 20 years ago.
Well, it's also a cheap format too, isn't it? I mean, that's the reason. But often you'll find, you know, I've been watching some Valentino films recently, and one of the things that really stops them from being a very satisfactory experience, and what makes them seem in the DVD form rather archaic and not as involving as things that I've seen live, is that the soundtrack is just randomly applied to the images. You know, it's like something on a 5-minute loop, and you'll get utterly inappropriate music, and it really does unpick the experience of a film, which is why I think, you know, when I watch a Valentino film, you know, this is the form that I've seen them in, they do seem rather unsatisfactory experiences, whereas my experience of Ivan Avello's films, regarded by, you know, orthodox film history as kind of carbon copies of the Valentino ones, they seem much more alive because I've seen them performed live.
And well, I mean, things like the guy from The Divine Comedy who was hired to write a new score for The Lodger.
That's right, yeah, Joby Talbot, yes, yeah. It's always, you know, I think in a way, the bad presentation, the poor presentation of work can sometimes lead to it being neglected, because when it's served up to you in a dodgy way, it sort of sometimes can confirm your prejudices about what a film of that period would be like. Something utterly archaic, something that seems primitive. And this is some, you know, silent cinema was absolutely not primitive. It's not like an imperfect version of the cinema we have now.
Oh no, I mean, you know, things like Eisenstein inventing montage. Well, some of the cutting.
If you think he did invent
montage. Anyway, I mean, but and like, well, to attribute him to something else, and say perhaps the rapid fire editing in some of his early films, you know, anticipates Requiem for a Dream. And people think, oh God, that's really modern. And then you watch this that was made 80 years ago, and you're, oh, actually, no, it's just been lost for, you know, 60 years. There are a few people today who are still making silent movies. I don't know if you've seen any of Guy Maddin's films.
Yes, I have. They're bonkers, aren't they, really? I mean, his sound pictures are bonkers, too. I remember Twilight of the Ice
Nymphs. Yeah, no, I've not seen that one.
See, hear how the field mice fight in the glen. I think that's a line from that. Yeah, I mean, they are... I mean, there's always been this intersection, I think, between...
I mean, he's obviously making himself consciously arty.
Yeah, but yeah. Say. And there have always been kind of arty people who have been rather intoxicated by the idea of the lost world of silent cinema and all that that conveys, that sort of seance-like quality, and the idea of creating, you know, that a self-consciously sort of archaic object is something that he's done, and done very brilliantly. But it'll always be, you know, like a form of loving an eccentric pastiche, won't it? I mean, it's not the same. Watching one of his films is not the same kind of experience as watching, you know, a film of the 20s, because it's an art house experience as opposed to a mass audience, mainstream experience. It's not a, you know, it's rather like watching a Guy Maddin film is rather like looking at a gothic folly on an 18th century estate, isn't it? It's that sort of idea. It's still very pretty, though.
Can you see any sort of more mainstream filmmakers trying to embrace the format?
Well, not really, except in the sense that dialogue is often burdensome in cinema. And, you know, generally, the lighter a film is on dialogue, the more cinematic it seems.
Yeah.
So, so that's certainly something where, you know, directors, they might still be looking back at the first 30-odd years of cinema and seeing things that that they can use. What, in a way, I think it has also a great influence upon is experimental film, but only in a way that I think sort of exposes the ignorance of experimental filmmakers who seem content to conduct experiments that some would say were satisfactorily concluded in about 1901. Mm. But if you look at, you know, watching, you know, if you say went to the Tate's big retrospective on films by artists, a lot of them seem like work from the silent period, but only because they're a self-conscious rejection of what they would see as mainstream Hollywood cinema.
Well, I suppose things like, say, Tasta Dean's films of lighthouses and things like that.
Yes, exactly, yes. Yeah. I don't know whether those people think are returning to the roots of cinema in a very self-conscious way, because my experience is that actually artists who make films know nothing about the history of cinema and don't even know very much about the history of films by artists.
One silent movie.
Tasta Dean aside, because she's from a dynasty of people intimately connected with British cinema. She is, you know, her Dean, and her surname comes from Basil Dean, who was the man who really created Ealing Studios. And she's also related to the Balkans, who obviously, you know, were the people who Michael Bockham was the person whose name is still associated with Ealing Studios. So the entire history of Ealing Studios is kind of in Tasta Dean's DNA.
Right. But what I was going to say is, at the London Film Festival a couple of years ago, I saw the debut film of a new filmmaker. I can't think of his name off the top of my head. I think it's Jay Petty or something like that, called Soft for Digging. And it was a film that he made while he was at NYU or somewhere like that. And until the last 5 minutes, where it falls apart, there's only one line of dialogue in the entire movie, so that he could record it non-sync, which makes it a lot cheaper. And it works perfectly well. It's a thriller about an old man living in a shack by himself in the woods who witnesses what may or may not be a murder, and then he goes to investigate it. You know, so it shows that it's still a viable way of expressing yourself in cinema. And then he went on to make Mimic 3, but, you know, you're all going to start somewhere.
But it shows I've not seen Mimic 3, but I do like Mimics.
Mimic 3 is not bad, actually. Mimic 3 is Rear Window with giant cockroaches.
Okay.
You know. So it is doable, I guess. How did you get this film in the first place? I mean, I was looking up your biography. You did a thesis on Wilkie Collins.
A thesis on Wilkie Collins, who didn't live long enough to be to go to see his work at the cinema, but some of his contemporaries did. I remember actually when I was writing that thesis, which was on Wilkie Collins. It was about mad boys in 19th century sensation fiction. Really. Which is a genre that includes Collins and includes people like Mary Elizabeth Braddon, who wrote Lady Audley's Secret and Aurora Floyd, and people like Rhoda Broughton. And Mary Braddon lived long enough to go and see an adaptation of... she gave her servants the night off, I believe, in something like 1913, to go and see a two-reel version of Aurora Floyd, her novel of the 1860s, in a cinema in Richmond. So from that sort of interest in the 19th century, I suppose I bumped into cinema on my way out of the 19th century, because I wrote a book called Inventing the Victorians, which had a chapter on Victorian cinema, and, you know, argued that really the essential grammar of cinema had been more or less established by the time Queen Victoria was dead, and that the films made before 1901 still remain... Still, you know, in them you can see the building blocks of everything that we have today, really. And so for that I went and scouted around in places where Victorian film studios had been. I went to places like St. Answell Park, which I've been back to again recently for a documentary called Silent Britain, and tried to find the site of this open air studio that they had, because most films of that period were photographed under natural light, so the studios were outside. And a guy called George Albert Smith, in this park in Hove, built a cinema that was open to the air, and films were shot there, you know, right at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. So that was what brought me into contact with silent British cinema. You know, I'd known silent American cinema sort of from, you know, watching it on the telly, really, and enjoying it. But it was only really when I began to wonder, began to go to the BFI and watch films from the teens and the 20s and sat there in the dark, hunched over a Steenbeck machine in the bowels of the British Film Institute, you know, watching these faces moving on the screen, tiny little screen on this editing, kind of editing machine that you have to watch them on, and wondering whether or not any of them could still be alive. Because watching a film of that period, especially in those, under those conditions, is rather like going to a seance. You know, you're sitting at this table, you see these faces with their Leichner number 5 makeup and their mouths moving silently on this tiny little screen. You're sitting there in silence, apart from the noise of the machine. Yes, and I just sat there wondering, could there be somebody in this frame who I could talk to? You know, might there be somebody in a nursing home somewhere in England, sitting there, you know, in their high back chair, telling their care worker that they used to be in pictures? And it turned out that there were a few of them, a very small band who, since I've interviewed them, have all, you know, inevitably popped off, really. And so that's where I began, really. It was sort of an archaeological idea, really, seeing whether or not I could put names to faces, whether or not there was anybody who could tell me what it was like to do this work then. And, you know, it was a matter of tracking them down and asking around and finding out who was still about, who could speak of those days.
You were saying about it being sort of like a voyage to a lost world or a seance. There are certain films, because, say, perhaps they have someone who is actually still known to people today, that do have that aspect. I was thinking of a film I saw with Houdini in it, where he's, you know, demonstrating his tricks. Obviously, to a certain extent, they're dulled by being on film, because the nature of watching magic on film, you think, oh, they, you know, stop the camera at that point. But even so, I mean, they obviously have a certain interest as, you know, people coming back from the dead, in a way.
Well, this is, the cinema is where we go to be entertained by the dead, in a way, isn't it? And silent cinema seems much more seance-like than post-silent cinema, because of the voicelessness of the actors, and partly also because of the orthochromatic film stock, which gives this slightly ghostly look, this slightly kind of heightened look to the faces of the actors. The makeup they wear is different from the makeup that people wore later, because of the kind of film stock that was used. And it just it sends them further back in time, in a way. And because of the circumstances under which you watch a silent film, you do feel like almost you're breaking through a barrier of some kind. It's not as corporeal as corporeal an experience as it is, you know, watching The Wizard of Oz or something from the 30s or 40s. Because you have this voiceless quality, there is a sense in which you do feel you are gazing far, far back into time. And it seems impossible that these people, in a way, could have had corporeal existences in the way that you know Judy Garland did.
Yeah.
Partly because they seem, because the coming of sound propelled so many of them into oblivion, so you've got this kind of curtain that descends upon many of these people, and they get lost at this stage. And people who were in the talkies in 1930, lots of them were still working in the 60s and 70s. So there isn't that feeling of, there isn't that discontinuity, that feeling of an end of something that you get with them.
It's not because they all had squeaky voices like Singing in the Rain.
Well, some of them did. Some of them had voices that were perceived to be unsuitable and that didn't match their faces somehow. But in a way, that's slightly exaggerated, because what happened was that as soon as the talkies came in, people thought, we need a new sort of star for this. We need people with theatre experience. The kind of acting that silent cinema demanded was not the same kind of acting that the talkie demanded. So producers and directors naturally looked elsewhere.
Yeah.
Some people did continue over.
Well, I suppose that's why, for example, many comedians continued over, because silent film cinema was as much about performance and exaggerated gestures, and slapstick comedy doesn't matter.
Well, exaggerated gestures, I mean, I don't know about that. It's just a different kind of acting. It's not something that's more over the top than talkie acting. It's just different. It had its own conventions, in the way that, I don't know, like kabuki has its own conventions.
Yeah.
they only seemed archaic. I mean, it seems, you know, it's a totally obvious thing to say, but they only seemed exaggerated in retrospect, okay. I think, because a different kind of acting had taken over.
Mm.
So I think, in a way, that's slightly an illusion of history, that...
Well, I suppose it's the same with any period of cinema history, that even films made in the 50s and 60s may be considered exaggerated to modern audiences because they used to jump cutting and B-list celebrities on the big screen.
Conventions change very, very fast, don't they? I mean, even that, you know, if in a film today you had people doing that kind of overlapping dialogue that you get in Orson Welles and in Howard Hawks films, that would seem bizarre and strange now. I mean, it would seem very odd indeed. Though it's not exaggerated. It's just, you know, you can't see the mannerisms of your own time as easily as you can see the mannerisms of 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But everything is mannered. You know, think of how exaggerated some kind of method performances now seem, that were, in their period, regarded as the height of naturalism. Mm. They now seem much more mannered than, you know, what Brando does. You know, it doesn't seem wrong, but it doesn't seem natural. It seems highly artificial in a way that what was regarded, other performances of the same period that would have been regarded, I suppose, as more conventional, more theatrical, don't seem to be less natural than what Brando does.
Mm. With your interest in cinema, you did a documentary called Silent Britain set between 1900 and 1920. You did one called Shepherd in Babylon, 30s up to the 50s.
Just the 30s. Just really. The 30s. It was sort of the end, coming of sound to the beginning of the war.
Can we expect more on following decades, or with the initials SB?
Not well, actually, I don't know. I hadn't thought of the SB thing. I am about to start working on one. Well, I'm doing two things at the moment, actually. I'm working on a series for BBC Two that currently has the title British Film Forever, which will air in the summer, and which will be 7 90-minute films about British cinema,
wow,
treating it thematically. So I'm helping put that together. It won't be kind of something with a presenter that you see, and I think Jonathan Ross is the voice that you will hear, but I'm writing the script for it. So that will cover romance and horror and comedy and the war, and it'll try and deal with things thematically. And lots of interviews being done from it, hundreds of people being interviewed for it. And I think that'll be, you know, that should be, it'll turn out really nicely. And then there'll be supporting material on BBC Four and screenings on BBC Four as well of some of these films. And I'm going to be doing a documentary, an hour, on the history of the British B-movie, which will follow the line that the B-movie is perhaps where we should go to really find out about British taste and British sensibility, because so many of the more expensive films have to play to a transatlantic audience. B-movie is not burdened with that responsibility, and so can simply please itself to some extent. And of course, in the form, you get all kinds of rather cute experiments, which might not have been allowed in a film that had to make money internationally. So you get much more quirky things going on in the world of the B picture, probably, than in the A picture. And also some rather surprising reversals. I mean, there are B pictures whose reputations have survived better than the films that were billed above them. Mm. And there are odd things like, you know, the Wicker Man was a B picture, for instance, supporting Don't Look Now. But those films, you know, have equal reputation now, I'd suggest. So the what was considered a B-movie is also quite a rich area of investigation. But I don't know whether we'll be able to call it something with the initials SB.
I'll have to ponder that.
B-something B-movie. Super Bs. I don't know. Can't be done, I don't think. It needs to be something longer.
While we're on the subject of movie soundtracks, if any teachers or educators are listening to this show, a week from Monday, the National Film Theatre in London is holding a one-day educational event about film music, including a talk by David Arnold. So check out www.bfi.org.uk if you'd like to get tickets. Next week, it's the first of two shows on the 30th anniversary of 2000 AD. So Duncan Knott and myself will be talking to the original editor, Pat Mills, about the history of the comic and the many strips he has written for the periodical. If you'd like to discuss tonight's show, please visit www.readyformyclosup.blogspot.com. And I'm Ready for My Close-Up. We'll be back at the same time next week.